From fuel cells to flow cells, living large on the GM board, and all the beauty tips for the sexy makeover of the Nissan Murano.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 274 for February 13, 2015. Nissan Murano rolls the design dice. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Gary.
John, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
So here we are in Farmington Hills, not Chicago. Today's first day of the media days in Chicago, but I'll bet it's colder out in Farmington Hills right now than in Chicago.
You could be right. And we got to tell everybody we got Joanne Muller joining us from Forbes magazine.
Thank you for having me after great, hours.
Great, great having you here. So you're not in Chicago either.
I'm not.
And we'll talk about the Chicago Auto Show later in this program, because there were some sort of interesting things that went on there. Mm-hmm. But we got to let everybody know that we got Chris Reed joining us right now. He's the overseas chief vehicle engineer for the Nissan Murano. Did I get that right?
You got that right, John.
All right. Welcome to After Hours.
Well, glad to be here. Terrific.
And he even brought a car.
And we've got the Nissan Murano itself here. I got to tell you, I got a chance to drive this as part of the North American Car and Truck of the Year Awards. Your people were good enough to bring one out to Hell, Michigan, where we do our testing. And I got a little bit of a drive in the thing then. And what hit me instantly, aside from the styling, we'll get into that. But when I got in it, what a comfortable vehicle. And I got to believe that was one of the things you really set out to achieve in doing this.
It really was. Yeah, I mean, obviously, we'll talk about the exterior later, but the concept car image, of course, was one of the main points. But secondly was the interior all day. And it was this, we had lots of kind of buzzwords we use, you know, a comfortable bistro and those kind of things. And I remember one time being out, we were having a kind of a customer clinic early in New York City. And we went over to the meatpacking district, and I found this restaurant. It was at lower level, and it had this ambiance feeling in it. And we had a bunch of the engineers there, and we're like, see, this is what we're trying to capture right here. A lot of fun.
What I remember in my drive, which goes back to, what, October now, was the seats just seemed wide. In fact, the whole vehicle seems wide. And I'm not saying that it's overdone or anything like that. I'm just saying that, boy, it just seemed like I could stretch out. And that the seats were especially comfortable.
Well, really proud of the seats this time. And, you know, we've had that kind of zero-gravity type seats.
I've heard that term used a lot, but I'm sure there's some of the audience out there that's never heard the term zero-gravity seat.
Well, it's interesting. So we've kind of studied the NASA, you know, information to look at what's the most comfortable seat. And this term zero-gravity seat kind of comes from that research. So it has to do with kind of the contact and profiles and how to kind of make the body feel with, you know, distributed pressure and kind of a very easy feeling within a seat. So we've done it. We tried it on our Altima. And then we decided that how can we kind of raise the bar and really restudied it again and really looked at all the pressure points. I focus a lot on the upper body because I've got the height. You know?
You're a tall guy.
Exactly. So I think it's one thing about being zero here, but we expanded the kind of contact points, you know, even added additional points throughout the lower body and the thigh area and then the upper body. I really can feel it when I'm in the car. The upper back and the relationship of the headrest, the whole balance. And, of course, we have it on the front seats and the two outboard rear seats. Mm-hmm. I think it's really, you know, it's just a great feeling. And that balance of, it's nothing to do with the softness, but at the same time, we you know, with multi-layer foam, you know, we kind of strategize to get it so you get a really good feeling in the showroom at the same time you've got good support underneath to dampen out the road inputs.
So this is the third generation of the Murano. So as you set about to create the new one, what were some of the goals that you were trying to achieve? I mean, John mentioned, obviously, interior comfort's one of them. But what are some of the other things that you wanted to bring to the car and to bring to the segment?
Well, that's a great point. So, you know, we think that we kind of created the segment a little bit the first time, and then it, you know, kind of evolved. You know, the second version was, you know, like well executed. We liked the model; it was doing well, and it was kind of, we call it an evolution. Kind of, we just kind of refined what we had, but it really didn't stand out. And everybody was catching up, moving around us for this kind of cutting edge look at what it wasn't cutting edge anymore. So this time we were like, we got to break the mold again. And that's where we came up with this concept of we need a concept car. We need a concept car that you could show, but it turns out to be a production car. And that was really our main goal. So it was like, we had to kind of break through the image of this kind of, you know, SUV kind of crossover becoming the new minivan segment in a sense. We wanted to kind of break the mold again and turn into a concept car. So the inside really followed along with that, but the main starting point was the exterior and that concept car-like feeling.
So that was, you guys had that, was it the Resonance concept that
exactly.
Was?
That's really interesting because we were working on actually the Murano before that, and at the same time we wanted to come to the auto show with something. It was really a teaser, and at the time it wasn't told it was the next Murano, but in reality we were working on those same cues in parallel for the Murano, and then our San Diego studio put that together for the Resonance, you know, and of course it was a big success, but we were working, you know, full steam ahead already.
So it was the real deal, but it was presented as a concept.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think I heard a couple of quotes which made me feel really good, which is that some people said, we actually like the Murano better than the concept car, you know, because usually people get disappointed, right? They see a cool concept car and you lose it. And we were really focusing on really challenging all the groups to kind of, you know, really achieve the shapes that are kind of concept type shapes this time. We did a lot of extra work to do that, whether it's the section of the door and making prototypes and make it work and push the limits of all of our teams. You know, very, very collaborative, obviously, as usual, and with the manufacturing is simultaneously, you know, engineering. But, you know, we have lots of criteria, like, oh, we're going to push the envelope this time.
I thought engineers only like things that are rectangular and flat.
That is really funny you say that, because my wife teases me a lot, because I hate symmetry. It's very uncharacteristic as an engineer.
No kidding.
I made this mantle over my fireplace, and it's unsymmetrical, which drives her crazy. But I think that kind of mindset moved into the car, right? You know, I hate smooth. I hate, you know, easy shapes.
Uh-huh. Well, you know what blew me away on the Murano was the interior of the car that I drove, same one that John drove in October for the Car of the Year judging, was I almost thought it was like mother of pearl. It was white with these streaks through it, and it was so bizarre. I just sat there for a few minutes and just kind of took it in, and I thought, I think I like this, but it is so unlike anything I'd seen before. I wasn't sure, you know, and it really grew on me, and I thought it was phenomenal, but I also thought it would be very polarizing, and I know you have some other interior color packages for people who, you know, don't like that much light and that much. It looks like shells.
Yeah, exactly. I think I remember the days we were debating that, right? Because you're looking at the natural materials. If you go with the wood, you go with those kind of things. And we're like, we're trying to be a little more, you know, cutting edge concept car type image. So that's where we ended up with that, you know, in the styling studios, creating those cool shapes. And it was polarizing. Even, you know, at the time we were selecting it, some people were, is it plasticky? Is it modern? I don't know what it is. And, you know, I think it was well executed in the end. And I just remember all the work of getting the patterns lined up and the consistency across all the parts, too. You take kind of a lot of risk because the mismatch can kind of give it a cheap feeling in the end of the day. But we did that. And I think one of my neat favorite points was, I don't know if you recognize it, but there's like a divider in the middle, an armrest. So it's funny because you'd think that was like a main styling theme. But
here it's up on the screen. Carmen's got the camera on it right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. And it was really kind of a feeling of kind of, we started with an image of connecting a tabletop. Kind of it's supposed to be like a bistro where you have four people in the car where it's easy to communicate and you talk to your friends, right, easily. And how do you do that? You kind of invite them from the front to the rear seat. So you're not looking around, you know, the headrests and being separated. We focused on, you know, rounding the shapes of the seats to make it easier. Of course, the things like wind noise and those normal things you would do. And then trying to connect the kind of that front to rear feeling in that little alley. And, you know, we struggled a lot about, well, what about, where's your elbow going to go? Is it going to fall between? And this is a little bit unconventional, so you're kind of taking a bit of a risk. But we said, we're going to do it. It was another kind of a neat factor that we executed.
I think maybe you could put the wallpaper on my house then. Although maybe you don't like symmetry, so yeah. Maybe you're not the guy.
Problem. Yeah.
But in this car, you managed to line up those lines in the grain of this shell-like
Well, exactly. I remember figuring out the hinge structure of, you know, it seems like it's just a hinge on the console box, but thinking about the shape of that hinge and being able to not disrupt that flow of the pattern, you know, one by one. So
it looks good.
It was fun.
Up to now, the Murano's always been made in Japan. This one's going to be made here in the U.S. How much of the engineering was done in the U.S.?
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah, you're right. It was built. We have a factory in Kyushu in the southern Japan, and that's where the last two of them were built. And this time, as a team, we decided it's time to build this in the U.S. In the past, the U.S. was the major market, and we started the design, and it actually was going to be built in three different plants globally. But we decided to make the U.S. the mother plant. And then we have a plant in Canton, Mississippi. So that was it was a big one for it. We hadn't had a new launch there in a long time, and it was time to bring the Murano there. And it's a global export, so it's exported. I think it's over 100 different destinations out of the Canton plant ultimately. So as far as the engineering goes, I mean, we have a pretty good collaborative system. So you know, the vehicles, you know, we have R&D centers all over the world, and we share and work together all the time. And this time we started it in Japan. I was in Japan for that, from the kind of the sketch phase of the project, and was able to live in Japan and actually work on it and then start that interaction. We have teams out in Arizona that are doing the kind of marketability and the target setting and all that evaluation. So we're kind of bouncing between the centers at that point to figure out the right you know, targets for the car. And then the teams start to collaborate kind of going forward from that point. And then there's kind of a transitional sharing as we move, you know, here. And then finally, you know, the last 2 years, we finished off everything up here in Farmington Hills, just up the street.
Just up the street from here. Yeah, exactly right.
Now, you know, Joanne was mentioning how astonishing it is that everything is lined up on the inside. And if we look at the outside of this vehicle, I'm seeing shapes and forms there that have to be awfully difficult to stamp, okay? Now, I can see the stylist saying, this is what we need this form, and I can see the manufacturing engineers going, maybe not. But you guys have done. So in terms of this development process, I mean, how did you get everyone aligned to be able to come up with something like this?
It's a great point, Gary. I remember we have a process that is probably not unlike everyone's process, where we have a selection. You go through sketches, and then you go through the mini models. And this one unique point about this one was that we started with the model phase, which is unusual. You know, we have lots of digital techniques that we can use, but this was kind of the rebirth of the Murano. So the first thing that we did, we started as a competition amongst the stylists, and they had to make I think it was a 1/10 or 1/12 size scale model, which is not our usual process. So that was the first thing to really start and kind of get involved in the model, kind of go old school on it. So that was the beginning of it. But then there's a competition. It's actually a global competition. We use Europe and Japan and San Diego, the styling studios, and they all start to grow up their ideas, and then we have these competitions and selection processes. Well, then when you go to each one of those, the R&D side, which kind of representing manufacturing, they've got to say that, you know, we can assure we can build all of these different, you know, new crazy designs at each phase. So you're studying 6 or 12 different variations at that point. And then you're on the line to be able to say that if we pick this, we can deliver it all the way. You know, and as the chief, you're responsible for not just execution, but, you know, the cost, the development, the R&D budgets, everything. So you got to deliver the whole product, quality, safety, everything. So you're kind of under a lot of pressure to look at the shape and then do your, you know, sectional studies and all your work in parallel with the guys like the manufacturing team who are saying you're trying to push them, but you know if you push them too far, you're going to have a huge problem in the physical phase.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like the big process. So I remember this great turning point. It was we'd already kind of whittled down the designs. We got down to two. And we have this thing called, you know, go with 6, then go with 3, go with 2, go with 1. It's like a big transition where you finally get all your energy onto the last model, which was this one, of course. So we were at a point where we had this kind of a very nice looking Murano, the next generation Murano. Then we had this one. And in reality, all the teams were saying that it was like a week before the selection. They were saying that people were actually kind of making fun of this one, saying like the styling team saying like, we'll never be able to do that. Why are they haven't met any of our criteria. We're not going to do it. So I recognized that the engineering teams were already making their decision. And I was like, no way, look at that thing. We're going to make this work. So at that time, it was in San Diego. So I got a body guy, I got a stamping guy, we got the aerodynamics guy, we had a safety guy, and lamp guy, exterior guy. And we just got on a plane, like literally in like very short notice, and just flew over there, met this guy named Alfonso Abbasio, and the head of the styling there in San Diego.
Now head of Infinity.
Yes.
Design.
Yes, very good. And his protege there, Ken, and we sat down, and it was like they were having trouble getting the communication perfectly, and we just worked it out in a handful of days. And then, of course, working it out means taking some risks. Like, we knew we were over criteria in a bunch of areas, and finally, we got the confidence level, went back to Japan for the competition, and I could commit to say, we'll deliver. You know, and of course, it's not just me, but it's everybody's energy, and I'm just the spokesperson at that point. But we committed to it, and everybody picked the model, and then that's what we got.
I'm curious what Carlos Ghosn had to say about that. Was he on board with this from the beginning? Or
Well, I think he has a lot of trust and faith in his groups, you know, so, you know, it depends, you know. You kind of get, sometimes he'll get very involved in a project, and this time we had, I mean, it was pretty much everybody, it wasn't really polarizing. Everybody was like drawn to the model at that point. You know, whether it was the lamps in the front and the rear view, all the views had something that was pulling somebody into it.
Mm-hmm. But the other one could have happened. Is
absolutely. Honestly, 3 days before that selection, that was the one that was going to get chosen.
Wow.
Because all the top executives, they, you know, it's like it's not a long study for them. It's a presentation, and they have to make a decision. So, of course, they're talking to all their people. You know, my bosses are asking me, like, what do you think? Can we make both of them? Which one do you think? Give me some points about each one. And I think everybody's planting all that information. So 3 days before, it was like, this one? No, it's not going to meet. We can't do it. We can't commit to it on R&D. We got to go with this one. I mean, that was like, that would have been the natural way to go.
Easy way.
But what was it? I mean, what was it that made you guys know that you had to pick the one that was,
well,
I
mean, you look at it, doesn't it just tell that to you?
I'm sure the other one looks great,
it's
too,
about,
though.
You know, engineering's job is to execute the sweet styling that came out of their group. So, you know, I'm a cheerleader, so it was just like, guys, we've got to do that. What are we going to do to make it happen?
See, but what I love what you're talking about is you're a true believer. You're a guy who loves cars. You're a guy who's going to drive to push the envelope. Mm-hmm. It would have been real easy to check the boxes on the easy way. It would have gone through the process, no problem. But you might have a much bigger hit on your hands and something that'll live in the marketplace longer for whatever 4 or 5 year cycle that you leave it out there for.
Well,
and I would hasten to add, I see a lot of the new Maxima styling reflecting what you guys have done.
You watched the Super Bowl?
I did, as a matter of fact.
Well, that's right. And there are the characteristic, the V grill and the boomerang and all these things and the floating roof. Those are all coming alive as kind of our, you know, this is our flagship sport utility at this time. So it's fun to work on that one. And, of course, the four-door sports car Maxima is the flagship sedan, of course, is going to carry a lot of these themes. So, you know, we raised the bar, but now, you know, we're happy to have them follow.
Now, this is a carryover engine in this vehicle?
Yeah, exactly. We actually have the same engine combination and CVT combination in our in the Pathfinder and the QX60 also that's built.
Well,
it's that
3.5-liter V6 that, boy, you guys have made a lot of money on that engine. That thing has paid a lot of bills.
Yeah, I mean, you get something that works, you refine it, you make it work, and, you know, we focused on, had good output. You know, this car, the Murano's a lot lighter, so we have good performance, and, you know, it was like, let's focus on what we should execute, and let's not reinvent the wheel on the engine that's working.
So it's a lot lighter, like 143 pounds or something like that.
Yeah, it's about that, right? It's like a test weight class lower, so we can take advantage of that, and then we could retune everything and make it work. It's a good.
So how did you do that? I mean, that's a lot of weight. I mean, it's not a small car.
Well, you know, you start out in the beginning and you put some pretty hard pressure on the R&D groups, and I was countless hearings, you know, every single part, you know, and, you know, have to ask the groups, present to me, give them like a 30% reduction in mass. And you've got, you know, some parts that are carryover, you're not going to take, you know, a lot of mass out of them. So it's a really big challenge. And, you know, we learned a lot of lessons from the past. I kept all those lessons learned that everybody would have. But, you know, in some cases, you go too far. You know, you thin up the headliner, you thin up the door. It's either noisy or it breaks when you install it or something. So you got to find that right balance and challenge the groups, but do it. So we made a lot of strides in the body area, though. We did a lot of kind of raised the bar on our high-strength stampings. You know, it's called 1.2 gigapascal. Megapascal steels, and you know, we were able to achieve a lot of the safety with these kind of very more expensive steels and with higher strength, so we could have less reinforcements in the end of the day. So the body had a lot of optimization that could really contribute to the fuel economy.
Mm-hmm. Are those zero gravity seats lighter?
Well, in reality,
yeah, they don't like a thing.
Just float around in there. Put it on a scale.
You suck your eyes into that. We made them lighter than the current model. We did optimize appropriately. So, you know, had a lot of... But in the end of the day, you know, the fuel economy... It was a big thing, right? We made a huge gains,
and 20%, I think,
yeah,
you guys are claiming.
Yeah, about 20%, and you know, that was driven. This was really kind of interesting because it was a kind of a conflict with what you're trying to do on the styling. So one of the things, you know, you've got lots of variables on fuel economy. Mass is one of them. That was more just pure raw engineering. We worked on that, and then you know, things like tires and rolling resistance. Okay, that's normal. No one really knows that. You don't recognize it, but it's there. But it was the balance of aerodynamics against the styling. So there's a drag coefficient, of course, that you measure the how the wind sees the car. So in the end of the day, in the values of drag coefficients, it's 0.38 about was the previous model. This is 0.31. So that is the same level as our G37 coupe.
Wow.
So the wind thinks it's a G37 coupe, which you wouldn't think. And I remember, you know, we had this very high aggressive target in order to hit the fuel economy. Because in the beginning, when you're on paper, you make a mass reduction, you calculate what the results have to be to generate this fuel economy. Because we had the starting engine. So you got the engine, and then you've got the contribution of the drag, contribution of the tires, contribution of the mass, all those things. And you set your targets, and then you just have to achieve them.
That's it for us now. We're going to hear from our friends at Firestone, and we'll be back with more about the Murano.
Sounds great.
And we're back.
We're back. And Chris, we've got some questions here from the audience. Speedy Sticks wants to know, is the Murano coming to the UK?
That's a good question. At this point, we
have a global audience here.
Yeah, well, that's excellent. It's at this time is not going to the UK. We studied it in depth, and
are there right-hand steer versions of it?
There are under development.
Okay.
So we, of course, that would be handy in the UK.
Yeah.
So at this time, you know, I think, you know, you never know what could happen in the future, but we do have a right-hand drive version under development, and we're working. You know, at this time, there's no clear visible plans for UK.
There's a smaller SUV over in the UK with the unpronounceable name.
Qashqai.
That one.
Yeah, we have something that looks the same size as our Rogue here.
Right.
The Qashqai is in doing very well in Europe.
But yeah, much smaller vehicle than this Murano. Mm-hmm. JM1NB says, how much time is put into the vehicle engineering versus the production engineering?
Well, we have something in Nissan called Manazakuri, and it's an interesting name, but it's the combination of those teams. And really, the only way you can be successful, and you know, where we don't build prototypes and we go right to production tooling on everything. In the old days, you'd have multiple lots, and you could kind of trial and error. Given that we don't do that, you have to do it all in parallel. So there's a dedicated team that works side by side all the way through the process. So. You know, I think maybe the magnitude of the R&D guys is slightly bigger because some of the inside stuff, you know, compared to inside of a part versus a part that you're just putting on the car. But it's very, very collaborative from the get-go. You know, that's the only way you can achieve this kind of styling, you know, and then be able to deliver it. Very collaborative.
Let's see here. There's a follow-up, too. Any of the technology from the GTR, the 370, the Leaf, or the Titan make it into this?
Well, you know, you have project teams, and then you have, like, the teams, like, for example, let's say the tire group, for example. So the tire group would have all the vehicles in Nissan tires, and, of course, one of them is the Murano. So from that standpoint, of course, you've got guys who are responsible for each of those programs or some leader who's responsible for those, and they're taking the best of those technologies and putting them across all their cars. So as far as specific examples... you know, I think it's more characteristics. So, like the device, like these are our best rolling resistance tires, for example. So that we're using from our best technology in tires, for example. So I don't have any great fun. Like we didn't use like the push to start button from the GTR or something like that. So you know, and it's got all the spirit and the blood of all those cars for sure. But you know, and because the same teams are developing those cars.
We've got several people here asking essentially the same question. We got Phil and Dakota from Burlington, Ontario, and Rivero Notario. They want to know, what about the convertible?
The convertible.
The Cross Cabriolet. What'd you learn from that?
Well, that's an excellent question. So we're not doing
another cross cabriolet
on this one. I had a chance when I went to Japan to start working on this Murano. I was in charge of, I kind of inherited that Cross Cabriolet convertible, and I started it before it went to production, actually. and it just got off on a bad foot. There was an earthquake in Japan, and the engines were made at the Iwaki plant that was right in the zone of the near the Fukushima radiation area. And so it got off to a rocky start from that standpoint. And then it missed the season. And then I think the press was not as excited about our concept as a sports car because it was a cool sport utility versus a sports car. But we learned a lot. And I have to say, I drove one. When I got back from Japan, I drove one because I worked on it. Even though I didn't do it from scratch, I wanted to kind of respect my one of my babies.
Well, maybe I saw you driving the only one I've ever seen on the road.
Wow, that's harsh, but we'll accept that.
Yeah, okay.
But we learned. I think we learned from the big picture of lessons from that standpoint.
Wright Knight's got a question. I'll sort of condense it. You know, everyone's going with these turbo fours. You guys got a V6. What's Nissan's thinking going forward here?
Well, we've got some things in our back pocket that we're still looking at in the future anyways, you know, and I think it's consistent with some of the directions like that. So, you know, we wanted to start with something stable that we already had, that we could really focus on the execution of the project, right? We're moving plants, we're changing the whole concept of the car, we're going with aggressive styling. So we have lots of ideas moving forward. So we just decided to stick with our kind of workhorse and have a good stable, V6 engine that we have a lot of background with that we wouldn't have to kind of have a brand new development on and kind of execute the Murano, and we'll move forward from there. But we've got some tricks up our sleeves coming.
Did you recalibrate the CVT settings for this vehicle?
Well, we did. Of course, it's somewhat balanced to the car itself. And one of the neat things we did, actually, which we've done on other models, too. It's kind of more of our theme, is we really looked at the way people use CVTs, the way they recognize the value of it. And, of course, it's a balanced power curve, and we're trying to optimize the efficiency of the fuel efficiency. And we recognize that in the end of the day, especially, I think I remember the first time I drove one where you get on the gas and you're in a hurry and you're like, what's going on here? It's like, is there something broken? Is it, And we focused on that whole concept, and we have something called D-Step. And it's really that when you're using the normal throttle response, you're just, getting on the gas like normal, you're not thinking about anything, you're getting the best fuel economy. But when you're really ready to go, past like halfway and you push harder on the throttle, you're going to get the feeling of a transmission where we actually tune the steps so you actually get the feeling of an automatic transmission. So when you're on the gas, you get the feeling, you get the benefits of kind of an automatic transmission feeling. And it took a lot of tuning to get that just right. See, it felt natural. And then versus when you're actually trying to use, not really pay attention to what your car's doing, but you just like to get good fuel economy.
Mm-hmm. I got to commend Nissan. It's committed to CVTs more than any other manufacturer. And boy, do they deliver real-world fuel economy. Yeah. I think every other automaker in the world is going to have to play catch-up to what Nissan's done in that regard.
Well, thank you. And, in reality, it's, achieving the fuel economy goals is not just one or two big things. It's a whole string of items. And you've got to get that 0.1%, 0.2% and many items. Of course, the CVT is a big contributor, much bigger contributor to that. But I think we focused on it. We've executed it. We've studied the driving patterns and the habits. And now we have something we think is a great balance that we're going kind of cross car line. This I think a marriage where you get the fuel economy of a CVT and yet you get the feel of a regular, more conventional feel that we're used to mm-hmm. when you're ready, when you need it.
So sure. What is the fuel economy on the Murano?
Well, it's 21, 24, 28. So 28 is the highway.
Mm-hmm.
The story I wanted to finish telling.
Yeah,
sorry.
That.
So, and it relates to 28 highway. So it's the drag coefficient. So it's this wind issue. So we ran like triple the number of wind tunnel tests. So, and of course, one of my responsibilities is the overall development budget. So, usually you're trying to not spend money when you don't have to. But it was like, we got to execute. We got to keep the styling. We got to protect the shapes. And, I love sitting and talking to the stylist guys about, it's so beautiful to think, like, the direction of a line is important, where like a regular engineer is like, what does that matter? Put a radius on there, it's fine. But it's like, I bought it. And I'm like, I got that. That curve back there on the back of that rear fender, that's important. And 5 mils this way is not good. And of course, all the regular engineers are like, 5 millimeters, are you kidding me? No one will know the difference. But we fought and pushed and pulled every single curve to keep the stylist's intentions, and yet finally achieve that 0.31 drag coefficient. So it comes back to that would allow us to achieve that 28 miles per gallon on the highway, and it was the balance. I mean, the light, the lamps are cool, but that balance of that inboard outboard position of that cool, kind of Some people call it bug eyes. I think they're really, really cool. But the pronounced rear combi lamp there is a balance still of the aerodynamic, the flow, and how it breaks off the back of the vehicle. So finally, we could achieve the great fuel economy with that with even aggressive styling.
That's really cool. Chris, I got to thank you for coming on the show. This is really cool. It's great to just feel your enthusiasm for this product, and the product looks $1 million.
Yeah, it does.
Yep. Well, enjoyed it. It was really fun talking about it, and it kind of brings back lots of fun memories. And I get excited. So
it shows in a good way, too. So, once again, thanks for coming on Autoline After Hours.
John, thank you, Gary. John, nice to meet you. Talk to you guys.
Mm-hmm. Great having you. We're going to take another quick break right now, and we got a lot more to talk about.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go.
So here we are talking all about the automotive industry, and the rest of the automotive world's in Chicago at an auto show.
What's wrong with us?
Nothing at all, right. So, Joanne, anything come out of the Chicago show that stood out for you?
Well, I think the most important vehicle there is probably the Honda Pilot. You know, they had a really good SUV a long time ago, and it really was passed by everybody, and it was so outdated. And, you know, they had some problems that they had to defer some spending, you know, between the earthquake and then the tsunami, and they had flooding and other places, and they just had to put off the investment. So they finally have come out with a new one. I think it's been like 7 years. So it is beautiful. I mean, it is a nice-looking vehicle. And as you know, Honda does a great CR-V. It's the number one mid-selling car. And I think that between now they're adding at the high end a new Pilot that looks phenomenal. And at the low end, this new HRV that they had showed recently, I think they got the waterfront covered.
They're in the sweet spot of the market right now.
They sure are. And they, you know, they've shown they know how to do it. So I think that's going to be a home run for them, both of them.
An astonishing 9-speed transmission is going to be available from them in the Pilot. Yeah. It'll be a six-speed will be the standard, and then they're going to have a 9-speed option.
Are they making that in-house? They tend to do that.
Yeah, I think the 9-speed's in-house, and I think they have an 8-speed that they're working with ZF on.
Uh-huh.
But, that was fairly interesting. And then, although I think that looks a lot like the CR-V, the styling.
Well, it does. It looks like a bigger CR-V.
Right.
You're right.
So it's gone from the very boxy shape that they'd had for the last generation that looked, you know, tough. To being
stale to me.
Well, it got stale for sure. But yes, it was much.
Look, all these SUVs, they all look the same now, right? Except for this one.
Yeah, no, it's a big change there. But
But I think they did a nice job on it. I think the packaging and stuff would be great.
Yeah, they did a nice job there. You know, and it's usually a truck show. I mean, so we saw that new Laramie, the very high upscale Ram truck.
Pickup, right.
And then there's a...
Well, hold on, because to me... The most interesting thing about that upscale Ram, and, you know, look, everybody's trying to lard it on to their pickups and make more profit, and that's what it's all about. But again, they've gone away from that crosshair grill that Ram has had forever.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, we're not abandoning that. But now here's the second trim level, because they did that sport truck at the Detroit
right.
show.
Mm-hmm.
Rebel? No, Revel? What was that?
Rampage?
How quickly I forget. But anyway, you know, they assured us that, oh, we're not going away from the crosshair grill. But, you know, boom, big three letters, RAM, plastered on the front of that grill.
Well, you know, I mean, they've got to build that out as a brand, right? And they're still trying to establish
that. Too many people still say Dodge Ram.
Exactly.
So
they got
to
make
sure it's just
so
a
Ram. You see those letters, it's like, okay, now I get, you know.
And then they did a refresh to the Chevy Equinox.
Yeah, that's overdue,
it's a good
too.
Thing they told us, because they didn't tell me that was the new one. I'm not sure I would have noticed the difference.
You know, the thing, though, with these pickup trucks, going back to that for a minute, is that they're just, you know, they're going so high and so expensive. I don't know who's going to buy these, you know? I mean, right now 40, 45 maybe.
Well, that's the average.
Yeah.
Average.
Crazy.
Mm-hmm. Look, I think there's more up to it.
Do you really?
Yeah, you got to be careful. You know, as long as they're trim levels and as long as the customer will pay for that trim level, you're probably okay. But if you start tooling up, I mean, really spending hardcore money to come out with something new, the downturn's out there. I don't know if it's
exactly
next year or the year after, but you're going to get slapped by that.
And the people who can afford to buy those are going to die soon. And you have all these young people coming up, right? And how are they going to afford those?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know.
Somebody's listening right now thinking, gee, I was going to buy one of those things. Lance says I'm going to die if I buy one. All right, so here's a question for you two. Lincoln Blackwood, was it ahead of its time? Remember that?
Yeah.
Well,
I forgot about that.
That's a good question. You know, can a luxury brand do a pickup truck, or do you just need luxury versions of regular work trucks? And my guess is if a Lincoln brand or any other luxury brand were to do a pickup, there's a fakeness about it.
But they had the Mark LT that was based purely on the F-150, which did okay. But just engineering a luxury pickup truck. What do you think, Joanne?
I think that fell into a period of time when Lincoln still didn't know what they were.
Let's say that's some luxury brand.
A BMW.
Or BMW or a
Maybach.
I would not buy. I think there's a lack of authenticity with a luxury brand trying to do a pickup.
I don't think it works. I think what makes pickups work is they're true to what they are.
They're authentic.
I mean, they got a bed and they got a cab and they can haul stuff and they're real. And if you do a luxury version of that, of the real thing, I think people will go for it. And obviously they are. I think if you did a luxury brand thing, then it's like, this ain't a real work truck. This is a poser.
Right. That's exactly the word I was thinking.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's because
Jerry wants a pickup with a three-pointed star on it.
I mean, you think about it. Okay, so how many of these people that are buying the fully loaded, unobtainium edition truck with, you know, extra whatevers and internet connectivity,
technology and stuff,
flat screen televisions and blah blah blah, whatever else is in there. How many of them actually put anything in that bed, ever?
Well, you don't buy it for what you're going to do. You buy it for what you think maybe one day you might do.
So when I have my luxury pickup truck, I'll just hire a truck to have it done for me.
And a guy with big muscles, too.
Absolutely.
What else? Anything else come out of Chicago? I mean, this is sort of like the trim level show, isn't it? I mean, with the exception of the Pilot, I don't think there was any.
Acura had an RDX refresh.
Yeah, the RDX, yeah.
You know, and Acura, you know, they're
yeah, it's a big 1-2 punch because, I mean, you look at their MDX and RDX numbers and, you know, in that segment, they're outselling everyone.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's interesting.
So, you know, they're saying, you know, you take the the BMWs, add them together, you know, the X5 and the X3, Acura's outselling them. You look at, the Audi, I think they're outselling them. It's just phenomenal in that segment.
Well, I believe it was Auto Trader had something interesting, too, today. They were saying that in Chicago, the RDX is the number 3 selling luxury SUV. It doesn't even crack the top 5 anywhere else in the country. So it's interesting that they showed it in Chicago, and I don't know what it is about Chicago that loves that car more
than
others.
Amazing regional differences.
Yeah.
That always impresses me.
And I thought it was interesting, so Nissan had a press conference today, and they didn't really show anything new, but they brought the car we talked about last week, the LMP car.
Yeah, the race car.
And the thing that I found to be astonishing is that one of the drivers is a guy named Jan Maidenborough, who won the GT Academy contest 3.5 years ago. Okay, this is PlayStation.
Yeah.
Driving cars.
Okay. Game station.
Yeah. And now he's going to be
driving the real one
at Le Mans.
How old is he?
Right.
He's a young guy, but I mean, they're all young guys. What the hell?
His driver's license, but I mean,
isn't that astonishing? I mean, to think about that, this guy wins a gaming contest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now he's being entrusted with, a stint in that car.
No, I'm real impressed with what Nissan's doing. It's really getting into racing in a big way, and I want to talk more about that race car in a second. But just to finish this thought, you know, it started this GT Academy. I think it started in Europe, and they wanted to. There was like, how do you get young people interested in cars? Well, young boys are really interested in PlayStation and other gaming station kind of games, and Nissan went, well, let's just not find out if they can do the game well. Let's see, you know, what else they can do in terms of strategy and setup. And it got more and more sophisticated to the point where the graduates coming out of this GT Academy are absolutely ready to step in as professional drivers. To your point, this guy, Jan, whatever his name is, he said, going to be racing at Le Mans this year.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
But the race car, which we talked a lot about last week, and I don't want to belabor it too much, but I got a chance to do a phone interview today with Darren Cox, who runs Nismo Motorsports Marketing globally. And that's one of the points that he was making, is that we want to make a big statement about how innovative we are. You know, we do the Leaf electric car, we do the GTR sports car, now we're doing this breakthrough race car. My interest was in what they call this flybrid. Instead of using batteries like every other hybrid does, so when you press on the brakes, you recharge the batteries and you use the batteries to accelerate, they use a flywheel to store energy, kinetic energy, not chemical energy like a battery. And then they feed it through the transmission. And what I find so interesting is this could be very, if they can prove it works and it's reliable, and that's what Darren Cox said, that's why we're going to Le Mans, you know? He says, nothing like racing twice around the clock to see if something holds together. And this technology is, it packages much smaller than today's battery electric hybrids. It's maybe a quarter of the cost. Mm. And so I find it so interesting that a Nissan that is the world leader in EV sales has poured untold billions into batteries is now pioneering this technology that could be very disruptive to their own investment. Mm-hmm. I'm blown away by it, and I admire them for doing it.
Yeah.
Well, whatever works wins, right? I mean, so that's how they're placing their bets.
No, I think it's the other way. Whatever wins works.
Didn't Chrysler do something with flywheels a long time ago?
Joanne, I'm so impressed.
I've been around too long.
Yeah. No, you're right. Back, I want to say circa...
Francois Castaing explaining it, I remember.
Yeah. Circa 1995, Francois Castaing, who was then VP of engineering at Chrysler, and who formerly ran all Renault Racing. Mm. He was the one who really pushed them into F1 in the late 70s and turbocharging and whatnot into F1. He wanted to get back into racing. And you're right, they want to do a flywheel car.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of using the flywheel to feed into the transmission, it was going to put out big bursts of energy, electric energy. But flywheels spin at very high speed, and if they fail, is like atomic bomb. And they've never confirmed it, but I'm pretty sure I'm safe in saying this. One of their contract development engineers was killed when this thing blew up in a test cell, and the program got axed, and that was that. And so I asked Darren Cox about that very thing. What are you guys doing with this? And he said, our flywheel is encased in its own carbon fiber structure, and that is encased in its own safety cell. So even if it goes kaboom, everything gets contained. But I find this fascinating technology, you know, storing energy mechanically, not chemically.
Mm-hmm. Right. Man, and if you can get the cost down, it is a game changer, right?
Right. It is.
But one bad bearing and
Yeah.
Thing ain't rotating so well.
Yeah.
Hey, let's take another quick break here, and then let's come back and talk about this guy nominating himself to the GM board and what we might do about that.
Yeah, I want in.
Hey, we're going to come back in just a minute. We're taking a quick break here, and we got to give a shout-out to our friends at
Henkel.
Henkel. Thank you, Gary.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
So, yeah, the news broke this week. Here's this guy, Harry Wilson is his name. He nominating himself to the GM board and says, come on, cough up $8 billion and start buying back your stock. What do you guys make of this?
Well, what's so ironic about it is that, you know, he led the team at the Obama administration that led GM through bankruptcy, you know, and now he's saying, oh, you got too much money now.
Yeah, that's sort of odd.
And I'd like a little bit of it. And by the way, he's working with 4 hedge funds, and he's got a deal with them where he gets a cut of the profits that they make on their investments, you know.
Oh,
I've got an
in.
He's
not doing it for himself.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no. This is
for the shareholders.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you had a good point on Daily about the amount of money that General Motors has compared to the amount of money that Toyota has and that Volkswagen has, and how this could put them at a competitive disadvantage.
Yeah, I think it's Volkswagen has $6 billion more in cash, and I think it was Toyota had $11 billion more in cash. And if you take out the $8 billion that Harry wants them to cough up, it grows by that much of a gap. And, you know, this is an industry where, man, you got to just keep laying cash down on the table all day long.
Well, and his reasoning is interesting, too, because he says, well, they're going to generate $3 billion in cash this year in 2015. So they're not, you know, that's $3 billion that we can just take off the table. And then we're only talking about $5 billion. And if you give us back that $5 billion, you're still in your safety range that GM has said, you know, we want to have 20 to 25 billion in cash on our balance sheet. So you end up with 20, you're still in your range. GM is smart to say, we don't really want to do that. They've been through the ringer.
Well, you got a UAW contract coming up. What's that going to cost? Yeah, you know, you don't know. They didn't know about this ignition switch. What about
the
next big fiasco?
The Justice Department hasn't even come down yet.
There's no fee.
We know it's going to be at least $1 billion because Toyota got $1.2 billion for their mess up from the Justice Department.
This is more vehicles.
More vehicles and longer and more mismanagement, shall we say, over a longer period of time. I think they're going to get hit hard by the Justice Department on that.
Just think $1 billion,
too.
At least.
Right.
Wait,
that's where it starts.
What?
So Toyota got $1.2 billion fine.
Right.
So I think GM's will be at least that much.
Minimum.
So what do you think the top side would be?
Two. 5.
Oh, jeez. Oh.
No, maybe not. 3? 3. I'll put that out there. 3.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
No, but I mean, if you just do it proportionally just using the benchmark of the Toyota situation.
I haven't really gone through that math in my head, but it's going to be worse.
It's going to be serious money they're going to have to put out just to take care of fines.
Yeah.
And, oh, by the way, they still got to develop cars.
Well, you remember the timing, too, of the GM, of the Toyota fine came out like one day or one week after the ignition switch thing broke. And there was no coincidence, in my view. And I bet that fine sent shivers down Mary Barra's back.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Holy mackerel.
Mm-hmm. Gary, you looked it up and you found out that if you sit on the GM board, you make
$200,000.
And what
How many meetings do you have to attend?
It's not clear.
Isn't it like four or five meetings?
So I was looking at the proxy statement. So each member of the board who's not an employee receives an annual retainer of $200,000 for service on the board and, if applicable, one or both of the following annual retainers: $10,000 for service as chair of any board committee and $20,000 for service on the audit committee. The fee paid for service as lead director is $30,000 per year.
So let's go nominate ourselves.
I was going to say. And
I want to be nominated to the GM board.
Mm-hmm.
And let's have fun. I want company cars.
That's okay. To enhance the public image of our vehicles, we provide directors with the use of a company vehicle on a 6-month rotating basis.
No, oh, 6 months.
Directors are.
I'm an automotive journalist. That won't do. I get more cars than that.
Directors are expected to submit product evaluations to us. So this is not a, just a free ride, you guys. Not a free ride.
Here's my product evaluation of the C6. Woohoo! Now what do I get?
Let's see. Non-employed directors are reimbursed for reasonable travel expenses incurred.
Does that mean I get a company plane?
There are no company planes.
Oh,
but
you're right.
When we're on the board.
It's a reasonable company plane.
No.
No. If you're on the board, you're going to make sure I get a plane?
Well, you know, they closed down GMATS, the General Motors Air Transportation System. We're going on the board. We're bringing that back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we got to nominate
ourselves. We're bringing that back. Right.
I think I'd like, if I'm on the board, I think I would bring back fuel cells, and I would make them put one in my home.
Remember when they used to tell us that?
Yes.
I mean, they'd take us up to Hoyon mm-hmm. Falls and show us
right.
and say, you know, you don't need to worry about, you know,
hey, listen,
no power outages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're out of power, just pour a bottle of liquor in there, and it'll just...
They haven't given up on that idea. You know, we had Mark Royce in here for the TV show last month, and they haven't given up on
Isn't
that.
Isn't it interesting, though, that they kind of stopped talking about it so much publicly, and Toyota's the one now that talks all about fuel cells?
Well, what Mark Royce told us, though, is the Honda fuel cell vehicle, mm-hmm. the FCV,
yeah.
that's the GM fuel cell stack.
Because
GM and Honda are working together.
Yeah, okay.
And then, you know, like, I want to say it's Mercedes or Daimler, Ford and Nissan are another group working together. And
Well, and then we just heard this week that
Volkswagen
has bought the
Ballard. Yeah.
Ballard. And
Ballard's
like, wow, what a name from the past, huh?
Yeah, I know.
And,
I didn't even know they were still
doing stuff. I went to their website. It's like, wow, they're still doing stuff. This is amazing. And, and then there was that other announcement today that in Japan, Toyota, Nissan and Honda are working on a fueling infrastructure for hydrogen vehicles, and so you know, I think that that's where hydrogen vehicles are going to really take off.
I was very impressed. This company in Germany called NanoFlowCell is coming out with a car at the Geneva show next month that they call the Quant F, and it's powered by a flow cell. And I had to go online and look up what it means, and I'm not sure I fully understand it, but it's kind of like having a battery where you recharge it by putting in fresh electrolyte.
So here's the deal. So you have these two containers of this electrolyte that they're not identifying what it is. And it sort of reminded me, the description sort of reminded me of, like, the last time I used Mr. Plumber. And I don't know if
you
you open it up, and it mixes, the two things come together.
Squeeze them equally.
And then it's just like, then all this foam comes up. So it literally sounds like that. So,
yeah.
so there are these two tanks that are on board that carry this, two 200-liter tanks. And so...
Wow. 200 liters is a lot.
So I checked the math, and that's 440 pounds. That's if it's water, so we don't know, you know, but it's not water, so this probably weighs more than that. So just a FYI, it's 117 pounds for a 14-pound gasoline tank if it were full of water. So, it's heavy. That's why it's a sport limousine that their first vehicle is. So basically they're running the thing through a membrane like you have in a fuel cell, and then somehow they're generating power as a result of this.
Electricity.
And then the question is, well, okay, so how much of this stuff do you use? And they say, well, none of it goes away. It all stays there. So all 400 liters will stay on board your car. It just runs out of magic or whatever is, whatever.
Pixie and dust.
So whatever is in it, that stuff goes away. And then you have to replenish it. Okay. So
where do you get it?
Well, that's come on, details, details.
You just have
details.
To build another infrastructure.
Yeah. Well, if this electrolyte
building
stuff.
A bunch of them, why not?
Just get Gatorade or something?
And
okay, it's got electrolytes.
And so then there was one Q&A, and it said, okay, how environmentally friendly is the NanoFlow cell fuel liquid? And the answer is the fuel liquid contains no environmentally damaging components. The electrolytic solutions are composed of various non-toxic substances. Okay, here's the kicker. If sufficiently diluted, they could even be disposed of through normal wastewater treatment plants. this if sufficiently diluted? What if they're not sufficiently diluted? Then what happens?
I don't know, but maybe they'll be bottling it.
Yeah, maybe we'll have 3 years. But, you know, this sort of reminds me of, okay, this would be a Geneva show, right? That Rinspeed, every year Rinspeed comes out with something really bizarre. So I was looking at some of their vehicles, and so like the, you know, how Mercedes had the concept of their autonomous vehicle in Detroit, which they showed at CES with it. Rinspeed had a model like that, like, 2 or 3 years ago, same thing. I mean,
are you kidding?
No, the same way, and this guy's. You know how the i3, how you can get that extra little thing. You know,
the extended range engine.
So Rinspeed has come out with this thing that basically is like this little trailer that plugs into your car. That's an engine
that you tow behind you.
But it's integrated. You know. So but it's just like it's so wonderful that there are these guys who are just thinking of these completely totally wacky. I mean, they made a car out of bamboo. I mean, it was just
hemp.
And the guy just keeps doing it. You know what I mean? And he's but the thing is that you look at the Rinspeed thing, and he has every major supplier, seemingly, that you've ever heard of is contributing to these vehicles. I'm trying to find any supplier related to this thing. None.
To the
nano
magic
cell.
Fluid electrolytes.
But this gets to a, I mean, I think the point is that, you know, as you think about all these scientists that are working on developments in terms of new chemistries and new battery technologies, and, you know, you're talking about flywheels and on and on and on. And so suddenly you have all of these people who are showing this tremendous fascination in transportation. I mean, how are we going to get from point A to point B, and how are we going to power this? Because if you think about it, I mean, autonomous vehicles, we don't talk about this very much, but autonomous vehicles are not going to be gasoline-powered vehicles. I mean, when they're fully autonomous.
You could be right.
And it seems to me they're going to have to be electric-powered. And I started thinking about this, and you certainly, John, and perhaps you even, Joanne, that if you remember... If you used to go into factories and they had automatic guided vehicles,
that'd be
rolling around on their own. And there was always a thing that if they were not in use, they would automatically go back to a charging place. I mean, nobody would tell them to do that. I mean, that was part of their programming. And I think that as we go to, you know, autonomous vehicles that, you know, it won't be your car, it won't be my car, it won't be your car,
it'll just be
a car. And when the three of us are not using this thing, when we're at work, this thing's going back somewhere and plugging in. Right? So it's going to be ready for when you get out of work, it'll take it.
No, you're exactly right. In fact, that's what Qualcomm is planning on. These are the guys that are developing the cordless charging, the inductive charging. That's exactly what their idea is with autonomous cars.
Right.
That when it's in between runs, it goes and parks itself over a mat that recharges the batteries. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it almost seems that you know, we're maybe in, like, auto industry 2.0 or, you know, some clever, techie-sounding thing that you know, we're going beyond from what we've been used to for the last 100 or so years to something different.
Yeah.
That's my thought anyway. But.
Hey, look, this is a great conversation. We do have a phone call and a question here that we didn't get to that's more for us.
Okay.
And maybe we ought to get to that. So, Ben, we got our pal from Cleveland, Ohio, with a phoner here. Let's bring him in.
Hi, guys. This is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio. My question is for Mr. Reed. If you could look in your crystal ball, give me an idea. Is that Nissan GTR, Le Mans, Nismo going to be raced in the American Series, the IMSA Series here in the States this year? And also, will it be the 2016 Le Mans race along with the 4GT and the new up-and-coming, shortly to be announced, Zora Corvette? Thank you. Later. Bye.
Well, that was really a question for Chris Reed. So,
didn't Darren Cox's last name, the Nismo guy?
Yeah.
Didn't he say that this is going to be at this year's Le Mans?
Yeah, it's going to be at this year.
Right.
Exactly right.
Right.
And, you know, first year efforts, you know, they're not going to win. I think I'm safe in saying that, and I don't think they'd argue too much with me. If they qualify well and put in a good showing before it crashes or blows up, they'll be happy. But, you know, take on the likes of Audi. Whew, man, that's a tough one. Porsche, even Toyota, that's going to be tough. I think if they acquit themselves well, they'll be real happy. 2016 is going to be the real serious effort mm-hmm. with it.
And I don't get the sense that they're going to be racing in this series here.
No, they are.
They are?
Yeah.
I thought he just kept sort of emphasizing.
They're pushing everything into Le Mans. What Chris or Darren Cox told me from Nismo today is that I think the first race is going to be Silverstone in England. And he says, don't judge us by that. We're putting all our effort into Le Mans. So all the aerodynamics, all the fairing, we're designing it for Le Mans. Now, we're going to race it in other races, but he says it's going to be the Le Mans setup, just so we get some experience under our belt. He says it will race later this year in the Circuit of the Americas, and he says they hope they're going to be far more competitive at that point. That'll be later in the season. Okay. So exciting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting, too. If especially your point about Nissan sort of disrupting their own business, potentially.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, that's what years ago, Carlos Ghosn said, hybrids, we're going with CVTs.
Right.
CVTs makes all the sense in the world. And he was right.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to see, in my opinion, every automaker, mass market automaker, have to get into CVTs now. They just work too well.
Well, going to the Wayback Machine, you guys remember when Honda had the CVT in the Civic? Remember? I mean, way back. I mean, you get CVTs now.
I don't remember.
You get CVTs in Hondas now. But, I mean, they had built a facility down in Ohio, and they were building CVTs, and they put it in the Civic, and no one bought
it. Remember the Subaru Justy?
Yeah.
That
had
a CVT.
Tested my memory.
Anyway, we ought to wrap this up. Joanne, great having you here.
Yeah, thanks,
we'll
John.
We'll definitely have you back. This
Thank
was
you.
A lot of fun.
Lots of fun.
And Gary, why don't we come back here next week and do it again?
Go to a GM board. No.
Yeah, I want to get on the GM board. I think that's a good gig.
Yeah, better than a journalist salary.
Except 6 months every car. I think we can fix that. We'll show them how it's
Especially if we're on the board. Yes,
yeah, you
course.
Got it. Okay, everybody, thanks for tuning in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Henkel, excellence is our passion.
Starting March 5th, Auto Line After Hours moves its live broadcast time to 3 p.m. Eastern Time and every Thursday. Again, that's March 5th at 3 p.m. Detroit time for Auto Line After Hours. Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.